this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, "Don't Gamble on My Retirement. The strength of North Carolina's public pension fund is dependent upon the accuracy of projected returns on investment. What if they're wrong?" And that's the headline on the front page. The story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline. Is North Carolina headed for a pension headache? If expected investment returns are too optimistic, state retirement programs could end up underfunded. And this article is written by Jason DeBruin. On January 21, a group that includes a retired teacher, a member of the National Guard, and a state law enforcement officer gathered with State Treasurer Janet Cowell. Their goal that day was to renew a plan that would secure retirement income of the nearly 1 million state and local government employees who will draw retirement checks from the North Carolina Retirement Systems, more commonly called the State Pension Fund. That fund is managed by the North Carolina Department of State Treasurer and ended 2015 in good health at $87 billion. Making it the 10th largest public pension fund in the country. To ensure it stays in good health, the fund's advisory board must provide a roadmap of expected investment returns and assumptions about retiree benefits. After discussions, questions, debates, and the help of a paid consultant, the advisory members settled on the amount of expected average annual returns from the fund. The growth rate they settled on is 7.25%, meaning the $87 billion fund will return an average of 7.25% per year for the next 30 years. If the pension fund hits that number through financial gains from investments in stocks, bonds, alternative investments, and more, it will see healthy growth. If returns fall short, however, the pot of money that pays retiree benefits could grow ever more underfunded. North Carolina, to cut retiree benefits or look to taxpayers to make up the gap. Leaving North Carolina to cut retiree benefits or look to taxpayers to make up the gap, a problem other states are wrestling with. This is a major issue facing the entire country, including North Carolina, and one that we shouldn't ignore, says Michael Jacobs, a member of the Pension Fund Advisory Board and a former senior policy official with the U.S. Treasury Department. I'm afraid that not enough people in North Carolina appreciate the magnitude of these decisions, which can have massive consequences in the future. The board's role. The full $87 billion pension fund is divided mostly between the North Carolina Teachers and State Employees Retirement System, TSERS, and the Local Government Employees Retirement System, LGERS, each of which is overseen by a 13-member board of trustees. Most of the members are appointed by the governor, and many serve on both boards. Members include teachers, state employees, a member of the National Guard, and others. Jacobs is a member of TSERS. He, along with Michael Mebben, a governmental securities advisor, were the only members who voted against the 7.25% projected returns because they believe the returns are too optimistic. The sheer size of the North Carolina pension fund is why miscalculations by even fractions of a percent can make such a big difference in real dollars. For example, at a compound annual growth rate of 7.25%, the $87 billion pension fund would balloon nicely to $710 billion in 30 years. However, knock that down just 0.25% to a 7% compound annual growth rate, and the total becomes $662 billion after 30 years, a $48 billion shortfall. Drop returns down to 6% per year, and the 30-year total shrinks to less than $500 billion. Of course, the pension pays out benefits on a regular basis, so it would never reach that actual size. However, those figures highlight the potential shortfall if investment return projections fall even slightly short. This matters to the beneficiaries, of course, because they can receive benefits only in as much as the fund has the ability to pay. It matters to taxpayers as well, however, because if the fund doesn't generate expected returns, lawmakers in future years might pull from the state's general fund in order to supplement the pension fund. Making projections. Ask fund managers about the past 30 years, and they will likely tell you that time frame was the golden age of investing. From 1970 through 2014, annual compound returns on large cap stocks were 10.5%, and on bonds were 7.9%, according to Charles Schwab Investment Advisory Incorporated. Unfortunately, the future doesn't seem as bright. Charles Schwab estimates long-term returns of 6.3% compounded annually for large cap stocks, and just 3.3% compounded annually for bonds going forward. Current and expected interest rates are much lower than what has transpired historically, especially compared to the high interest rate environment of the 1980s, according to Charles Schwab, which also estimates a lower future inflation rate. In a breakdown of class asset, about 43% of the fund is made up of stocks, while bonds make up 28% of the fund. The remainder is spread in real estate, private equity, or other alternative investments. Chip Snively, a senior finance lecturer at UNC Kenan Flagler Business School, notes that while stock returns might hit close to historical norms in the near future, bonds will likely fall short. He called bonds the real drag on overall investments. Interest rates are not going to go up without significant consequence to the economy, he says. We are going to be in a low interest rate environment for a while. While stocks receive more media attention, mostly because of their higher volatility, bonds are the much larger overall investment market. On the whole, Snively says pension plans across the nation have tempered their investment projections. The question is, are they being conservative enough, he asks. I'll go on record and say, I don't know. He later added that, I think 7.25 seems like a reasonable return projection. How North Carolina stacks up. Importantly, North Carolina's pension fund is currently in good health. Even with returns of just 0.3% in 2015, it is still more than 90% funded. Other states are already in a much deeper hole. The Illinois Teachers Plan and its 400,000 participants, for example, is 40% funded. Closer to home, the Virginia Retirement System, with 711,000 members, is 66% funded. North Carolina is considered an exemplary plan, says Monique Morrissey, an economist with Economic Policy Institute, who specializes in retirement security. They are literally the poster child of conservative and prudent pension management. Still, just because the North Carolina Fund is healthy now does not mean it will stay that way. Even a well-run fund like ours faces major issues in the future, Jacob says. If you look at how mortgage-backed securities were seriously mispriced by all major players before the crisis, the story was not that Goldman was doing anything worse than normal in the industry, but that there were systemic problems with the valuations of everyone's portfolio. Addressing the what-if. The Department of State Treasurer did not make Treasurer Cowell available for an interview, and she did not respond to an email seeking comment. She has already announced she will step down from her role at the end of 2016, although she has not disclosed any future plans. The TSERS and LGERS boards hired Buck Consultants, a division of Xerox Corporation, as a financial advisor, which recommended the 7.25% return assumption. Through a spokesman, Buck Consultants declined to comment or to answer emailed questions. Members of the TSERS and LGERS boards who voted in favor of the assumptions did not return emailed questions. Through a statement, the department says it has taken a conservative approach to the pension fund that includes a stabilization policy that effectually smooths the state taxpayers' contribution. We are all pleased with the quality of the retirement system and its managers, says Mebbin, but in the same breath warns that shortfalls in the early years can hamstring future returns. This is if we hit 7.25% year after year, he says, pointing to a chart of expected returns. What if we don't? I believe a more conservative approach is always policymakers. A more conservative approach allows policymakers an opportunity to respond in a more timely manner. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Friends in High Places. It was the third night of the Garth Brooks concert on March 13, but as GB stated, as he always does at his concerts, it was the most raucous. With plenty of seats available in the nosebleed section, the 14,000-plus crowd got a solid 2.5 hours out of Brooks and his wife, Trisha Yearwood, as they sang crowd favorites throughout the night. "You really cannot beat the price given the quality of the show," Biz heard Paragon Bank CEO Bob Hatley say while tailgating hours before the show. Brooks, who hadn't been to Raleigh for a concert in 18 years, originally planned for two nights with all tickets priced at $74.98 apiece. He added the third show after the first two quickly sold out. Disabled vet will have new family home in Holly Springs. It's lucky number 13 for Marine Staff Sergeant Brandon Taylor, who's been chosen as the 13th recipient of a new home sponsored by Raleigh-based Operation Coming Home, a nonprofit program that builds and donates homes for disabled combat veterans who have served in the Middle East. The 5-bedroom home under construction in the new Morgan Park community in Holly Springs is the charity's first partnership with national home builder CalAtlantic Homes, or with either of its legacy companies, Standard Pacific Homes and Ryland Homes. CalAtlantic Homes Executive Chairman Scott Stowell and its President and Chief Executive Larry Nicholson made the trip to Holly Springs from company headquarters in Southern California to participate in the ceremony March 14. Taylor, a husband and father to three boys, has served in the Marine Corps for 10 years, including 4 deployments to Africa and the Middle East. He was wounded during a raid in 2014 where he sustained severe back, spine, and knee injuries that caused him to be sent home and limited his ability to walk. The Taylor's new home in Holly Springs, which should be ready for move-in by Thanksgiving, is being designed with wider doorways and other features that can accommodate wheelchair access as Taylor continues his rehabilitation and medical treatment. Chapel Hill welcomes Florafidi displays. The Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership, CHDP, has been working with local artist Carter Hubbard to decorate the streetscape in downtown Chapel Hill with Florafidi. Hubbard uses fast-growing clover seeds to spell out inspirational words and designs. As the plants grow, the words become illegible, and the art disappears. "People love it," says Meg McGurk, executive director of CHDP. "Kids spell out the words. People stop to take photos with them. I've consistently heard from the community how much they love finding them as they walk along." Hubbard's work is currently on display in the mulch and raised planters along Franklin Street and a few other spots in downtown Chapel Hill. The search for clues in North Carolina shipwreck. Chalky conditions have stymied efforts to view a Civil War-era shipwreck up close, says Deputy State Archaeologist Billy Ray Morris, but the ship discovered last month near Oak Island is likely a vessel called the Agnes Fry, based on its size, he says, but he plans to confirm that hypothesis with archived ship plans. "It's one of the best-preserved blockade runners I've seen," he says of the ship, which was tasked with getting supplies through Union blockades. Once visibility improves, he plans to deploy multiple sonars to get a glimpse of the ship from the inside. Specifically, he's planning to use a sonar developed by the U.S. Navy to hunt mines with a head that pivots 260 degrees. Duke students reach Sweet 16 in Inc. Startup Contest. 2 Duke University student-athletes, Ivana Dumanian and Gabrielle Levesque, have made the final 16 cut in Inc. magazine's Coolest College Startups. Their startup, Biometrics, tracks an athlete's training and recovery with a wearable sensor dubbed Biomix, spelled B-I-O-M-X. The startup recently raised $10,000 through an Indiegogo campaign and plans to launch its product this fall with 3 NCAA Division I institutions. And finally, we have the tweet of the week. Thank you at Beard Foundation. We at Death and Taxes NC are deeply honored and experiencing a notable amount of hashtag joy. That's from Ashley Christensen, chef and owner of the Death and Taxes restaurant in Raleigh, which was named a finalist for a 2016 James Beard Foundation Award for Best New Restaurant. The tweet also linked to an Instagram photo of Christensen holding a miniature figurine of Joy from the Pixar film Inside Out. Winners will be announced May 2nd. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The headline, K. Hufnanian Homes to Exit Triangle Housing Market. Executives of national home building firm K. Hufnanian Homes have decided to shut down operations at its only North Carolina office in Raleigh, as well as in Minneapolis and Tampa Bay, with plans to focus on markets where Hufnanian Enterprises has a higher market share. In 2014, K-Hub ranked at only number 18 among the largest new home building companies in the Triangle, with 85 homes built in the year. The company, however, had been increasing its pipeline, with 103 home sales in 2015 at an average sale price of $307,272, according to residential research firm Metro Study. Jay Colvin, regional director of Metro Study, says K-Hub controls roughly 300 lots between its 8 active communities under development and those still in planning stages in the Triangle. Yes, it was a surprise, Colvin says, of Hufnanian's announcement to close the Raleigh office. The company had started to grow again, and they have some quality positions in the area. Ara Hufnanian, chairman, president, and CEO of Hufnanian Enterprises, in a conference call with investors on March 9, laid out the company's plan to exit the Triangle market, as well as Minneapolis, via a bulk sale of all of its properties to one or more buyers. Hufnanian also plans to exit the Tampa market as soon as all existing inventory is sold. We've just begun to market the Raleigh operations with strong preliminary interest from a number of builders, he said. Hufnanian did not disclose which builders might be interested in the Triangle portfolio, but many of the largest national builder groups in the market, including Pulte Group, CalAtlantic Homes, Meritage Homes, and M&I Homes, have been buying up large swaths of land in the Triangle and land banking properties in the region for future development. Most of Hufnanian's property holdings in the Triangle are located along the NC-55 corridor in Cary and Apex, as well as one in Chapel Hill. Hufnanian had been building homes in the Raleigh market since 1986, following the acquisition of New Fortis Homes. CalAtlantic vies for top Triangle position. The two top executives of CalAtlantic Homes, the new company created by the $5.2 billion merger of California-based Standard Pacific Homes and Virginia-based Ryland Homes, were in Holly Springs on March 14 to celebrate the groundbreaking of the company's first Operation Coming Home project for a local wounded military veteran. But the event was also the first public appearance in the Triangle for CalAtlantic Executive Chairman Scott Stowell and President and CEO Larry Nicholson since the merger became official in October. The event also became a rally for the company's 102 employees in Raleigh, who, over the last 4 months, have been working through the sometimes sticky details of merger integration. Of the 41 metro areas and 17 states where CalAtlantic has a presence, only 9 divisions had overlap with Ryland's territories, and one of those was in Raleigh. Troy George, Raleigh division president for the merged company, would not give a specific number of how many people had to be laid off as a result of the merger, but he says the merger process is complete and that they are ready to move forward. Company statements to the news media at the time of the merger stated that about 10% of the company's combined 2,752 job positions would be cut, or about 280 positions. Pre-merger, Standard Pacific Homes ranked as the third largest home building company in the Triangle, with 556 homes sold in 2015, behind Pulte Group and Lennar Homes. Ryland Homes also ranked in the top 15 in the market in 2015 with 163 homes sold. George says the company has about a 3-year supply of land and lot positions in the Triangle, already with a goal to increase production to more than 800 homes per year in 2017, That would put Cal Atlantic in the range of $240 million per year in home sales in the region and within reach of current market leader Pulte Group. We're not intending to be the biggest, but we're very fortunate to have great positions, and we think they will absorb very well, George says. In the Triangle, Cal Atlantic Homes has properties in 20 neighborhoods under development, mostly along the NC-55 corridor in southern Wake County. We're the second largest builder in Raleigh now, and we'll be pushing maybe for the largest market share potentially, Stowell says. Trophy buildings at Durham's Imperial Center come to market. Two offers for six prominent office buildings inside the Imperial Center Office Park in Durham have come to market within a week of each other. Two deals that could have a combined market value of more than $135 million. East Dill Secured has secured the listing on the 11-story Quintiles Plaza office tower, one of the most prominent properties overlooking Interstate 40 in the Triangle, and a building that could sell for more than $77 million. The 259,531-square-foot building at 4820 Emperor Boulevard is fully leased to Durham-based contract research firm Quintiles, which uses it as the company's corporate headquarters. In a separate offer, Cushman & Wakefield has brought to market the listing on five multi-tenant office buildings at Imperial Center, owned by principal real estate investors. The Imperial Center portfolio offer includes the Carlisle Place, Yorkshire Place, Stratford Hall, Cambridge Hall, and Canterbury Hall buildings that have a combined 367,717 square feet of rentable office space and are currently 98% occupied. Anchor tenants in the principal-owned buildings include Pathian Pharmaceuticals, Interactive Intelligence, and Bioventus. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, CRO support firm Clintrax acquired 3 years after launch. Just a few weeks ago, Brandon Evans' phone rang unexpectedly. It was a cold call from WIRB Copernicus Group, or WCG, to gauge Evans' interest in a partnership. On March 9, WCG announced it acquired Raleigh-based Clintrax Global, the company Evans founded with Elizabeth Easley and Stephen Jones just 3 years ago. It was a very quick deal, Evans said on the afternoon of the acquisition announcement. It really seemed like a natural fit. From the outset, Clintrax knew it would need to find partners at some point in order to reach the scope they wanted. They just didn't realize it would happen so fast. Clintrax works on the business end of clinical trials, helping drug companies in areas like contract negotiations, budget development, site payment, and resource placement to make sure those clinical trials run without a hitch. Our biopharmaceutical and institutional clients continue to cite, among the top impediments to clinical trial activation, the delays associated with negotiating study budgets and contracts, says WCG CEO Donald Dicio. By adding Clintrax Global to the WCG family of companies, we can now offer them a more comprehensive and integrative suite of study startup solutions. The Clintrax founders came from PRA Health Sciences, a large contract research organization based in Raleigh, and spun out partly because they recognized a need in the industry for the specialized service they now offer. By more than one measure, they were right, as their revenue grew to $7 million last year, a hefty 1,800% jump from 2013. In an interview earlier this year, Evan said he was looking forward to placing on the 2016 Inc. 5000 list of fastest-growing companies, but has no qualms about giving that up. It's a wonderful feeling that we are now a part of something bigger, he says. Financial details were not disclosed, but WCG acquired 100% of the company. Clintrax will operate under the existing name in the same Raleigh offices, and Evan says there will be no layoffs. How Salix and Sprout deals affected Valiant's earnings. Deep into the financial statements released by Valiant Pharmaceuticals International Incorporated on March 15, is a line item for restructuring and acquisition-related costs that would interest onlookers of the Triangle pharmaceutical industry. In total, Valeant incurred cash payments of $124 million for restructuring, integration, and acquisition-related costs in the fourth quarter. Of those, $54 million were related to Salix Pharmaceuticals, and another $3.2 million were related to Sprout Pharmaceuticals, both formerly based in Raleigh and acquired by Valeant in 2015. The pharmaceutical giant has received heightened national media attention in the past few weeks as it is under a federal government investigation related to high drug prices. The company is accused of acquiring old drugs and quickly increasing the price. CEO Michael Pearson took a leave of absence due to a hospitalization related to pneumonia, the company said, but has since returned. He was stripped of his board chairman position, however, which was taken over by Bob Ingram, the former GlaxoWelcome CEO, who now lives in Durham. More recently, two other well-known Triangle names, Tom Ross and Fred Eshelman, have been named to the Valeant board as well. The company delayed reporting its fourth quarter results and cut revenue forecasts by 12%. Valeant shares traded below $35 for the first time since 2010, after soaring to nearly $260 in the middle of last year. The challenges of the past few months are not yet behind us, and our goal for 2016 is to better balance our priorities across all of our constituencies, physicians, patients, employees, payers, debt holders, and shareholders, Pearson said in a statement. I want to again thank all of our dedicated employees as well as the entire management team for their diligence throughout this difficult time to ensure that the business remains solid. And in a section called Pharma Brief, Patheon cuts deal with global biotech company. Durham-based pharmaceutical services company Patheon has reached a manufacturing deal with Amgen, one of the world's largest biotechnology companies. Patheon contracts with biopharmaceutical companies to help them formulate and develop new drugs and also to manufacture commercial batches of drugs or therapies. And finally, in a section called Big Numbers, $210 million. Planned investment by Grifols, a producer of plasma-derived medicines, in two expansion projects in Clayton. The investments here are part of $360 million the Barcelona-based healthcare company will make around the globe, and $8.3 million proposed project by Cedars of Chapel Hill to expand by 30 nursing beds. The project requires regulatory approval and would bring the facility to 74 licensed nursing beds. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn over to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onisorge. The first headline, Plant Science Sector Growing at RTP Despite Local Cuts. Despite layoff reports, the state of plant science in Research Triangle Park is strong, say executives. It's just changing. As Monsanto packs up its RTP laboratory and heads back to St. Louis, and BASF notifies employees of a company-wide restructuring, other companies are upping their stakes, such as AgBiome, an upstart with a $35.5 million funder under its belt. With more than 50 employees, AgBiome is already hard at work at its new RTP greenhouse laboratory, says Chief Operating Officer Larry Duckwag. AgBiome develops new products from microbes, the tiny creatures already present in the soil. The company's first product, a biological fungicide dubbed Howler, contains a living microbe purported to protect crops from fungal diseases without chemicals. It's just one of the upstarts on a growth trajectory in RTP, and part of what's boosting AgBiome and others are the traditional ag players, says Paul Ulanch, executive director of the Biotechnology Crop Commercialization Center at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, who blames the commodity markets for reductions at Monsanto and BASF. Growers across the globe are looking at their pocketbooks, he says. But commodity prices aren't going to stay down forever, so agriculture giants have to keep innovating. One thrifty tactic is to partner and invest in upstarts, Ulanch says. Monsanto, Syngenta, and Novozymes are all strategic investors in AgBiome, for example. But even with the growth of upstarts, the net, at least on the surface, appears to be a jobs loss. Joel Marcus, CEO of Alexandria Real Estate Equities, which is currently refurbishing the 150,000-square-foot building in RTP for the Alexandria Center, says sector growth is coming. So far, interest in Alexandria Center has far exceeded our expectations, he says. While he can't be specific, Marcus says the plan is to recruit new companies to RTP, similar to what his company has done with other research campuses in places such as New York. And that, he says, means jobs. Progress is excellent, and we're pretty bullish, he says, adding that he does not see net deceleration in the Triangle ag tech scene, pointing to growth at enzyme maker Novozymes and ChemChina's looming takeover of Syngenta, which runs research and development in RTP. The acquisition of Syngenta will probably make that company even bigger and better, Marcus says. And in a section called Market Report, Lenovo is number 3 in server shipments, number 4 in revenue. More than 2 years after it announced it would be acquiring IBM's Research Triangle Park-based x86 server division, Lenovo, which has what it calls a dual headquarters in Morrisville, ranks 3rd when it comes to server shipments. But Lenovo trails 3 players when it comes to revenue. The top 4 server vendor shippers for the fourth quarter of 2015, according to research firm Gartner. HP at number 1, 625,543 shipments, or 21.2% of the market share. Number 2, Dell, 527,736 shipments, or 17.9% of the market share. Number 3, Lenovo, 256,571 shipments, or 8.7% of the market share. And number 4, Huawei, 149,742 shipments, or 5.1% of the market share. And finally, in a section called They Said It, we are still definitely expanding in Raleigh and are considering a few different options for the space on West Street. And that's from Jesse Lipson, co-founder of HQ Raleigh, speaking about changing plans for the Southwest Street site the co-working initiative purchased last year. And the next quote, "The biggest change is that we have a much bigger platform for Ansible. That's where an acquisition by a global company really helps. We could have gotten there, but we can get there much faster with the reach Red Hat has." And that's from Todd Barr, Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Ansible, which was acquired by Red Hat last October. And finally, "We'll make some noise by rolling out our most expensive go-to-market program ever and letting everyone know we're a force to be reckoned with." And that's from Suzanne Miglucci, CEO of Charles & Colvard, telling analysts the jewel maker plans to target millennials. And now we have an article in the economic development section. The headline, "Emails reveal JOCO scrambled for giant CSX project." Internet emails released to Triangle Business Journal show officials worked feverishly to try and secure the CSX Intermodal Terminal project, also called CCX, starting in April 2015, before they even knew the name of the company and months before the January 14 announcement. By the time Selma Mayor, Cheryl Oliver, and the Johnston County Commissioners were advised of the plan in December, officials were already deep into announcement preparations, reviewing a CSX project summary detailing the $99.9 million it would need from the state to double the track at the site and make freight facility improvements to support the $272 million project. On the day the project was announced, emails from Johnston County property owners had already started to pour into the county. County Economic Development Director Chris Johnson reacted quickly asking CSX via email about conflicting accounts coming from landowners. "It's only day one and we just don't want to see things quickly escalate," he wrote. Commissioner Ted Godwin wrote on January 17 that while he learned of the project generalities in December, he didn't know specifics until that January announcement. "As I have learned more about the project, I will be an active and vocal opponent of the entire project, not only north of Selma, but anywhere in JOCO, or Johnston County," he pledged to multiple constituents. He and his commissioners organized a meeting January 20 to discuss the project and were met with an emailed plea from Louis Rengel, vice president of CSX. "A move by the board tonight to withdraw support for the project would undermine the collaborative process and prematurely close the door on what we agreed would be a transformational economic opportunity for Johnston County residents," Rengel wrote. Records show. Commissioners on January 20 released a statement of opposition anyway. Project critics have been matched by those emailing the county about how important the terminal is for economic development in the region. "In the long run, the project may not prove to be viable for a variety of reasons, but we will at least know that we gave it a chance and showed that our towns, Johnston County and North Carolina, are sincerely interested in economic development," wrote Oliver to area officials January 26. "There are no projects of this magnitude that do not have an element of controversy," she wrote. Johnson doesn't seem to think the project is entirely dead, writing March 3 that it's likely the county won't see any movement on the project before the primary election season concludes. "I, too, am optimistic, but it will take time," he wrote. And now we're going to read from a special section in the Triangle Business Journal called Healthcare Heroes. The main article is headlined, "Spending His Life to Repair Human Genes. Dr. Aziz Sankar's journey leads him to win the 2015 Nobel Prize in Chemistry." And this article is written by Jason De Bruin. Alfred Nobel said his award should be given, quote, "for the greatest benefit to mankind," unquote. Dr. Aziz Sankar of UNC Chapel Hill already fulfilled that charge in his chemistry work and now continues to strive to improve mankind with the help of his elevated platform. Sankar, who along with Dr. Paul Modrich of Duke University and Dr. Thomas Lindahl of the Francis Crick Institute in the United Kingdom, won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry last year, was born in Turkey in a small town very near the Syrian border. He completed medical education in Turkey and received a NATO fellowship that allowed him to come to the United States to further his research. As an immigrant who spoke little English, however, life wasn't always easy. "When I first came here, I really had serious adjustment problems, partly with the language, but the other part was that I had no friends and I was very isolated," he says, "and I always wanted to do something about that for Turkish students who come to the United States." As he and his wife Gwendolyn assimilated into American culture, they wanted to give back and help future generations of Turkish scientists who come to the United States. They decided to leave their estate as a place where Turkish students could stay and assimilate to American culture. That plan fast-tracked in 2007 when Sankar received the Vebi Kök Award, a prestigious award given in Turkey that comes with a $100,000 reward. "We talked about it and said, well, instead of waiting until we die to make this happen, let's use this money," he says. Now the Sankars have dedicated the Nobel reward, or about $950,000, to the same mission. "In my experience, especially when I first came, Americans didn't really know much about Turkey. I think it's important that we understand one another so we don't have conflict. I've seen the misery of the refugees in my hometown, and I don't want to see that anymore. And I think the best way to prevent this is to understand one another," he says. The Sankars own a house on East Franklin Street where they take in Turkish students and are in the process of expanding that mission. They would like to see the university and town of Chapel Hill use it to improve cultural understanding and relations. Work on DNA. Sankar won the Nobel in Chemistry for his work on DNA repair, but his studies were not always in that field. He earned a medical degree in Turkey at a young age and then trained his eye on research. One of his first stops in the U.S. was Johns Hopkins University, where he researched molecular biology and then moved on to the University of Texas at Dallas, where his research turned to DNA repair. "I was very fortunate to work for the person who discovered DNA repair," he says, "and therefore I learned it from the source." Gene cloning was invented at Stanford, but was still in its infancy in the mid-1970s, and that is where Sankar focused his Ph.D. work. "I believe I was the first one east of the Rockies to clone a gene," Sankar says. "When I cloned the gene for the DNA repair enzyme, it was a major discovery in the field, and, of course, I wanted to do more with it. But my advisor decided that I had done enough and gave me a Ph.D., so then I went for a postdoc." He and his wife then worked together at Yale University. After 4 years of postdoctoral work, he began applying for jobs with the stipulation that he and his wife, also a scientist, be accepted together. "I applied to about 50 universities, and no one wanted me," he says. Sankar applied to some 50 universities after being one of the first to clone a DNA repair gene, but didn't receive an offer. About that time, a scientist at UNC happened to be working on some of the same research in DNA repair and heard that Sankar had cloned the very gene he needed. The UNC biochemistry department was in need of molecular biologists like Sankar. On a visit, Sankar said that he wanted his wife to have a position as well. "I believe it was the first time in the South that a husband and wife were hired as a team," he said, calling the university and its leaders very forward-looking for the time. The year was 1982. From there, the research took off, ultimately leading to the Nobel Prize. Name: Dr. Aziz Sankar. Organization: UNC Chapel Hill. Title: Sarah Graham Keenan Professor of Biochemistry and Biophysics. Age: 69. Birthplace: Savur, Mardin, Turkey. Education: Doctorate in Molecular Biology, University of Texas at Dallas. Medical degree from Istanbul University School of Medicine. What are your chief responsibilities? "I am a Sarah Graham Keenan Professor of Biochemistry and Biophysics at UNC and a member of the Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in the School of Medicine. My main responsibilities are threefold: manage my research efforts in lab, teach our graduate students, and provide service to my department and school." What do you enjoy most about what you do? "I really enjoy science and solving problems through collaborations." What were some of your major accomplishments in 2015? Recipient of the 2015 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Published a paper in the journal Genes and Development detailing our invention, which enabled us to create a DNA repair map of the entire human genome. How does your work impact patients and others in the healthcare community? "My research has directly opened avenues for the prevention and treatment of cancer." If you could change one thing about healthcare, what would it be? Make high-quality healthcare a right for all Americans. What do you do to relax and have fun? Watch UNC Athletics. I am particularly fond of the women's soccer team. What do you like most about living in the Triangle? The people, the academic endeavors, the sports. I'm proud to call it home. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Executive Voice column, and this one focuses on Donald van der Vaart. The headline: Scientist turned policymaker faces tough questions. And this question and answer column is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. As secretary of a department that's been embroiled in coal ash investigations for the past year, North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality Donald van der Vaart is no stranger to contention. "We're not done yet," he says, adding that public hearings continue. Both the process and the criticism his office has received is frustrating, he says, adding that battling misinformation is part of his job. "Critics attributed our motivation to trying to protect our bureaucratic turf, which is insane," he says. "We've got 40 or 50 people working on this right now. It's a huge effort. It is a monumental task." For Van der Vaart, who says he can't envision working outside of the public sector, it's just one of the challenging tasks he's faced since being appointed to the post in January 2015. But the questions he's had to address aren't limited to coal ash. Reports show he and Governor Pat McCrory have had a private meeting with Duke Energy executives, reports he says the media is blowing out of proportion. If you look at my publicly available calendar, you'll find I have meetings with Duke all the time, he says, adding that he meets with all kinds of groups, from the state's largest utility to the Sierra Club. There's nothing secret about that meeting. That's a great example of a non-issue. And Van der Vaart says he's befuddled that people are so interested in what he calls an innocuous dinner. It was about the topics we would talk about, he says, such as the environment and economic development. If it was so secret, why in the world would I have put it on my calendar? Van der Vaart will tell you he's not a politician. Prior to his latest appointment, he held several roles in the department, including deputy secretary, energy policy advisor, and program manager. A Raleigh native, Van der Vaart says he just wants to make a difference. Right now, he has a favorite talking point, nuclear energy, a type of power he calls clean in every respect. There is no way we can get significant reductions in coal without going nuclear, he says. He's pushing for nuclear to be a bigger part of the energy conversation in North Carolina, and says that without it, the state could be behind when it comes to power. What did you want to be when you grew up? I wanted to be a chemist. I loved conducting experiments and was also inspired by my father, who was a scientist. What's the biggest challenge facing the Department of Environmental Quality in the coming years? The one that's on my mind right now is the fight of federal overreach. We legally challenged the federal government twice last year and have been successful so far in getting the court to halt implementation of the Federal Power Plan and Waters of the United States until our legal challenge is resolved. The court's rulings are strong indicators that we'll win our challenges. However, this may not be the last time we have to contest a federal regulation that hurts North Carolina's economy without helping the environment. What NCDEQ project are you the most proud of? One of the most recent accomplishments is the drastic improvement in North Carolina's air quality. We were able to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel sources by more than 25% since 2005, and we're on track to reach a 30% reduction by 2030. North Carolina currently has the cleanest air that has been recorded in the past 25 years of monitoring. What's been your greatest professional challenge thus far, and how did you overcome it? The use of environmental issues by some for political purposes. We make all decisions based on science and public input, but various outside groups use the environment to launch political attacks against the administration. What is the biggest misconception people have about nuclear power? That it's not as clean as other energy sources. Every source has its risk, as you can see with coal ash, but nuclear is, in fact, the cleanest source of energy. It has no emission and minimal waste in comparison to energy output, and a nuclear facility can operate up to 80 years. You've said before that nuclear power is the future. Why? Nuclear energy is the future of baseload generation. It's the cleanest energy source and produces a lot of energy compared to its footprint. We still need other clean energy sources, like solar, to provide peak load generation. What's the biggest misconception that exists about your office? A lot of the agency's work gets misrepresented in the media. I'm proud of our accomplishments, which include improved air quality, cleaning up coal ash, assessing Duke Energy the largest fine in state history for environmental violations, and passing common sense regulatory reform that will protect the environment while allowing for economic growth, to name a few. We work hard every day to better this state through environmental protection and clean energy production. If you weren't at NCDEQ, what do you think you'd be doing? I'd be working at the department within the Air Quality Division or working on energy issues. My passion is environmental protection. What's your favorite vacation spot in North Carolina? the beach. It's my favorite spot to go with my family, and we try and make the trip as often as we can. And now in the small business section, we'll read the In the Workplace column written by Edward Marshall. Dr. Edward Marshall is founder and managing partner of the Marshall Group, LLC. He is the author of Building Trust at the Speed of Change. The headline on this column, Why Organizations Need People-Smart Leadership. There is an up-and-coming leader in a global IT firm, Ray, who is known as the smartest guy in the room. He has been a top performer for years, is well known for his executive briefings of customers, and his solid strategic sense. In fact, he's so smart that whenever he goes into a meeting with colleagues, everyone waits for him to weigh in on the issue of the day, since there's no point in having a different view. You're most likely going to be made wrong. He also has the ear of the senior vice president, so Ray speaks with power as well as smarts. Ray's problem, however, is that he just got some rather difficult 360 feedback. His colleagues don't like working with him, are fearful given his proximity to the SVP, and don't find the meetings very helpful. Ray was flustered by this information. He didn't understand. The essence is Ray is business smart, but people challenge. He's got low EQ. Recent research sponsored by the American Association of Collegiate Schools of Business found that among the most critical skills executives need in this complex global marketplace are the ability to build trust-based relationships, effectively collaborate with others, and engage the workforce so that they are aligned with senior leadership. Ray does not possess any of these capabilities. In company after company, we see people who are technically good at what they do as engineers, project specialists, or salespeople being promoted into the leadership track where they have to manage people. Sometimes this transition is possible, but more often than not, what made them successful on the technical track impedes success on the management track, as in Ray's case. In fact, based on the 360 data, he realized he was probably in the wrong job. What can senior leadership do in this situation? Here are some perspectives. Leadership EQ is more important than IQ. Work gets done through people. Leadership requires high EQ, empathy, and understanding of what motivates people. Collaboration and trust building are essential capabilities. Leaders must know how to effectively collaborate across silos, cultures, levels, and geographies, as well as build trust, which is the new currency in business. Workforce engagement and ownership ensure success. Millennials and Gen Y expect to be engaged and own their work. If they don't, they leave. Imagine the impact on business if an entire workforce owned the strategy, goals, and process. Make the decision quickly. If a leader cannot change their people's smarts, cut your losses quickly. Don't drag it out and victimize your workforce. Revisit how leaders are identified and selected. If there is a pattern of business smart but people challenge leaders, it's time to reconfigure your recruitment and selection process. The future of business leadership belongs to people smart leaders. At the end of the day, you can have the best business plan, strategy, and funding, but execution is done through and with people. They have to own it to take care of it. It is leadership's job to make that happen. And now we'll turn to the Viewpoint page where we have a guest column headlined, Bank Branches Are Slowly Disappearing. And this is written by Robert Terry, who is managing editor of the Washington Business Journal. My bank is closing. To be clear, the too-big-to-fail financial institution that manages my hundreds is not going under. Rather, the Bank of America branch about a mile from my home is closing in June. I was informed in a letter, how ironic, that arrived last week. My nearby financial center is closing, quote, because fewer customers have been visiting us here, unquote. Though the letter offers reassurance, we're still here for you. There are a couple of full-service branches nearby and thousands of ATMs, I'm reminded, and of course today there are more ways to bank, by computer, tablet, and smartphone. Bank of America has been shuttering branches for a couple of years now to cut costs and respond to changes in customer behavior. In 2010, there were more Bank of America branches in the U.S. than Walmart stores, Quartz reported. Bank of America's mobile banking customer base, meanwhile, has doubled to more than 17 million people. At the midway point last year, 13% of its checks were deposited via a mobile device. That number is sure to be higher now. Banking was my life's lone holdout to the encroachment of mobile technology. Security was a big concern, and besides, ATMs are everywhere and there's a branch a mile from my home. Until there isn't one. To Bank of America's credit, it's moving slowly but deliberately to a time when a brick-and-mortar bank branch is about as necessary as a set of encyclopedias. It's offering customers an alternative, educating them on how to transition as seamlessly as possible. There are sure to be hiccups along the way, but it's managing expectations. We're still here for you. Heck, I deposited a check with my phone for the first time recently. It's a safe bet that all of us, either personally or organization-wide, are riding the powerful currents of tech and market-fueled displacement. But we don't have to feel powerless in the face of potential obsolescence. Disruption will strike again, and when that happens, we need to strike back. After all, when one door closes, another door opens. And in our final minutes, we'll look at the Business Survey Pulse, which asks the question, have you already filed your taxes? The number of responses were at 425. 59% responded, of course not, it's March. 32% responded yes. And 9% responded, I'm filing them this week. And we're going to stop there as we have run out of time for this today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.